do have some ground to cover, so we're going to get moving here. But I think I would like to digress momentarily, if it's okay. By virtue of Rob Mann and his family, they find themselves in the season of imminent matrimony with the double blessings, the double portions of two engagements, betrothals in their family. So this is a good thing, and it's good for us to see this. In the Jewish tradition, it's called the Irusin. The Irusin is the time of betrothal. What's interesting in the Jewish perspective of this is that a betrothal is a legal arrangement. Granted, they're allowed to fall in love, and they love each other, and they should. That's right. But it's a legal arrangement. It's a framework by which these two who are betrothed are actually one. They're considered one. The blessing is that they are one in all ways except marital relations. And so they're one legally and they're one practically. They just don't live together because that would be impractical. That wouldn't work. But everything else, they are one. In fact, when a betrothal has to end, which sometimes it does, it's a legal severance, much like a divorce, very similar to a divorce. So you've got this, these two are one, except for they haven't consummated their union. They're one. And then on the day of the wedding, the bride comes in and the bride is veiled. She can't see the groom. She is seen by the groom, but she can't seize the groom completely. They are one until the consummation of the marital ceremony, which ends, of course, in a feast, because everything's about eating. Everything we do with a meal. Well, isn't that what we have? We are one with our Messiah. We are the bride of the bridegroom. He sees us clearly. We can't see him. We are one with him until that day when we see him face to face, when our veil is lifted, and then we come together with him in the booth, and we have our meal. That's the marriage supper of the Lamb that it talks about. And so this betrothal time is for us, as we watch you guys going through this, is for us a reminder of where we are with the Messiah. So I just wanted to take that little detour, if we could, before we start. It's good for us to celebrate that. It's good for us to be reminded of that, of where we are. We're going to continue this morning in Genesis chapter 32. Elder Tom, sir, would you stand and pray for the ministry of the Word this morning, please? This morning, I did a little detour back in time to 1985. And there was a hit song around that time, I believe it was 1985, plus or minus, called We Are the World. And to basically address some of the starvation and famine in Africa, a bunch of pop music celebrities got together and recorded this moving anthem, We Are the World. We are the ones who need to make a better place, so let's start giving. We are the world, we come together, and we're going to make the world a better place. It is this striving, this pushing. We have, after the election of Barack Obama, there was a sense, a palpable sense, among media, among the news, that the world is going to be better. We have striven for this breakthrough in race relations in our country. We have striven, and we have made the world a better place. But we have this myth of a cohesiveness, a world that strives together to make things better. And then we also have this opposite myth, which is just as evident in culture. And that's the myth of one, which is be all you can be. The tagline for the military advertising a few years back was an army of one. I am an army of one. Again, you have this nobility, you have this myth, this John Wayne character type that strives, that breaks through, that strives against creation, that strives against humanity, that strives against injustice. The examples are numerous in film and pop culture. The reason they are numerous is because this is a type of us. We strive. We are a people who strive. This is our character. This is who we are. Tennyson wrote a poem called Ulysses in 1833. The last lines of this poem are, "That which we are one equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield." So this is the character of mankind. We strive, we seek, we find, we break through, and we don't yield. So this is the context of chapter 32. We're going to do a brief survey through this, and then we'll come back and we'll address it from some of these perspectives of striving. So if you'll turn with me to chapter 32, verse 1. Jacob has returned from Laban, from Haran in Babylon. Remember last week he set his mitzvah, his watchtower that will guard his steps, this watchtower that will keep him from straying back to the land of Haran. He now sets his face to the land of Canaan, to the land that was promised to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Verse 1. Now, as Jacob went on his way, the angels of God met him. Remember when Jacob was fleeing from the wrath of his brother, he laid down in a certain place, and he called that place Bethel. He had a dream at Bethel, and the dream was the ladder that had the angels of God going up and down. So he ran into the angels as he was leaving Canaan, or the promised land. And here he is on the verge of coming back in. And again, he sees these angels. Verse 2, Jacob said when he saw them, this is God's camp. So he named that place Mahanaim. Jacob has seen the camp of the angels. The angels are surrounding his camp. It's like a camp around a camp. They're protecting him and his family. So this is the context. He's coming back into the land, and he has the blessing and protection of God, the security of God as he comes into the land. Now Jacob turns his attention to Esau. Interesting to think, Jacob hasn't seen Esau in some 20 years. Jacob went to Laban, and he worked under Laban. Laban was a liar and a cheat, and it was a difficult circumstance. But interesting, he didn't have to confront Esau. Jacob didn't have to confront his own sin. Sure, it was a difficult time, but he didn't have to confront himself. Now, he's coming back into the land, and he has to deal with Esau. Now it's a reality. Verse 3, then Jacob sent messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. He also commanded them, saying, thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male and female servants. And I have sent to tell my lord that I might find favor in your sight. Notice first of all the humility. He says, my lord Esau, I am your servant Jacob. Now, in truth, Jacob was given the blessing and the birthright. So technically, if you want to make a claim, Jacob and Esau are likely at least peers. If not, the other way around. Esau might be the subordinate one, if you want to fight it out. But notice that he's taking the path of humility. And he says to Esau, I've been in Haran under Laban this whole time. I've been under Laban. I didn't travel the known world. I wasn't a grand adventurer. I didn't make my profit. Everything came to him during this indentured servitude for Laban. Laban is the son of Abraham's brother. So it's likely that Laban was a known character, a known quantity in that family. It's likely that Laban had a reputation. So Jacob is telling Esau, it's been no picnic. I've been under Laban this whole time. But God has been faithful, and God has blessed me. He says, I've got donkeys and oxen and flocks, male and female servants. So God has blessed me. And then he says, he sent all this to tell my lord, Esau, Jacob says, in order to find favor in your sight. So what's interesting is that Jacob is taking the first step. He's offering the olive branch. He's looking for a reconciliation. He's not slinking around the countryside, avoiding him. He didn't send in emissaries into the land to build up allies so that he could confront Esau. His first move upon entering the land, or on the eve of entering the land, is to reach out to Esau. So this is what he does. Verse 6, we continue. The messengers returned to Jacob saying, we came to your brother Esau. Furthermore, he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him. Jacob just dealt with the pursuit of Laban. Laban and his kinsmen pursued Jacob 7 days. Remember when Jacob left Laban, he left in the night in a hurry, and it took a few days for Laban to find out. So Jacob had a head start. It took 7 days for Laban to catch up with Jacob. If you look at the geography and you look at the timeline, it's likely that Laban was pushing 40 miles a day. Laban was, and this takes us an hour to go 40 miles. Back then, it took a little longer. 40 days is a hard day's march. So Laban was pushing, and he caught up with Jacob, and God diffused the confrontation with Jacob, but there was still some tension there. Laban ran him down on the border to the promised land, and then God diffused that. Jacob turns, makes contact to Esau, and the first thing he hears is Esau is coming with 400 men. Esau is from Edom, and Edom is a rough and rugged land. These men are coarse. They are hard men. This is not an easy lifestyle. These are desert warriors. And Esau is a wild man. He fits right in. And he's coming with 400 of these men. 400 men, even in today's standards, 400 men is a credible force. It's a force to be reckoned with. And they can do some serious damage regardless of what they're going up against. So this is the context that Jacob has to deal with. Now, Esau is coming. Verse 7, we continue. Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people who were with him, his flocks and his herds, camels, into two companies. For he said, if Esau comes to one company and attacks it, then the company which is left will escape. So Jacob does the last clever thing he can think of. He divides his camp into two camps. Now Jacob is at the end of his good ideas. And so he prays. That's always a good place to go. So let's look at this prayer, verse 9. Jacob said, O God of my father, Abraham, and God of my father, Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and of all the faithfulness which you have shown to your servant. For with my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he will come and attack me and the mothers with the children. For you said, I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which is too great to be numbered. First of all, notice in this prayer how Jacob begins. Remember, it used to be God, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac, right? That was how Jacob addressed God before when he was with Laban. And here it says, God, the God of Abraham, and the God of my father Abraham, and the God of my father Isaac. So we see some movement. We see some progression. Next, notice the pattern. There's a very deliberate, methodical pattern here. In the first sentence, verse 9, who is he praying to? He's praying to God. O God of my father and God of my father Isaac, O Lord who said to me, return to your company. It's all that. This is who you are. And then in verse 10, very clear, it's who I am. I am the one who's unworthy. I am the one that you have shown faithfulness. I am the one who has become two companies by your blessing. So it's establishing, okay, there's you and there's me. Verse 11 is the appeal. Verse 11 is a request. Deliver me, I pray. Deliver me from the hand of my brother, for I'm afraid of him. And then verse 12 is a justification. In other words, he says, for you said. So deliver me because you said you would do this. Okay? So we have this pattern here. On the one hand, I see humility and goodness all through this prayer. But look again and notice that the prayer has a methodical format to it. It's a, okay, God, you're this and I'm this. Now I need you to do this because you promised that. You made this promise. And we have this tendency in our interactions with God. Not all of us do it, not all of us do it all the time. But we do have this tendency in our mindset towards God to take His promises and to use those promises like a crowbar to leverage His blessing. You said you would bless me in this. Now bless me in this. You said you would take care of me. You said you would provide security for me. And that is the tendency of human beings. We have that approach to God sometimes. And it's an immature approach, but it's one that we can struggle with. And I think that's a little bit of what's happening here. You have this appeal, this framework, and I will give credit that it is he does have a humility before God, and he does turn to God. But I want us to just keep that in mind, that kind of leveraging, that kind of approach to God that says, okay, you promised this, so you have to do this. You can't let this go. So that's the end of verse 12. That's the end of his prayer. Continuing on in the beginning of verse 13, it says simply, so he spent the night there. So he has this situation. Esau is coming with 400 men. Jacob splits his family, his flocks, everything into two camps. One camp will probably survive. And then he prays. And then it's night. And night falls. Night comes, and Esau and 400 men are coming at speed. I can imagine it was a difficult night. Probably didn't get much sleep, a lot of thought, and a lot of worry. And so the next morning comes, and look what we see. Finishing out verse 13, it says, then he selected from what he had with him a present for his brother Esau. Jacob is selecting a present for Esau. Let's look very carefully at the present. This is really interesting. 200 female goats and 20 male goats. Verse 14, verse 15, 30 milking camels, 200 ewes and 20 rams. 15, 30 milking camels and their colts, 40 cows, 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. Jacob is being very careful and deliberate here. Look at this, 580 animals in total. 200 female goats and 20 male goats. Female sheep and male sheep. Milking camels with their colts. Cows and bulls. Donkeys and donkeys. Male and female. It's a veritable Noah's Ark. Jacob gave a gift to Esau that would be a good start. Jacob gave a gift to Esau. This gift is everything you would need to assure prosperity. If you wanted to give somebody a good start, this is the gift you would give them. Because it's enough animals that if a couple die, you've got others to replace them. You've got male and female of five species. Now, what's interesting here, though, is that at this time, Jacob and Esau are at minimum at least middle-aged. They may be older. But they are at least middle-aged. Esau is already prosperous. Inasmuch as he wanted to be, he was a wild man. And he lived among wild men. But he was prosperous in his kind, in his way. Jacob was already prosperous. So why is this gift important, this gift of an assurance for growth and prosperity? Remember, Esau first scorned his birthright, which means he had contempt for his birthright, which means he had contempt for his father. But he scorned it. He gave it up. He traded it for a bowl of soup. But Jacob lied and deceived his father in order to take the blessing. So Jacob stole the blessing. That's the reality of what has happened. So Jacob is giving Isaac the blessing. This is the kind of blessing a father would give to his son. Jacob is giving back the blessing. It is a form of recompense. It is a form of, okay, I'm giving you this because I took this from you a long time ago. It's acknowledging. It's a form of repentance. Yeah, I did this. So I'm going to give you. And the numbers of 200 of these and 20 of those, 200 sheep, 20 male sheep, the numbers is excessive and over and above in order to overcompensate. Because when you steal something, you give back more in order to recompense. Right? In the Torah, the law says if you steal, you give back seven times in some cases. And I think 10 times in other cases, depends on the context of what happens. So you give back times over. Jacob is acknowledging, okay, I did this. This is the idea that came to him in the night, and I believe God helped him walk through what he was going to do. This is his plan. This is what he does in the morning. So, continuing on, Jacob assembles this gift and lays out a plan to present this gift to Esau. Verse 16, please. He delivered them, that is, all these flocks, his gifts, into the hand of his servants, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, pass on before me, and put a space between the droves. He commanded the one in front, when my brother Esau meets you and asks you, saying, to whom do you belong, and where are you going? To whom do these animals in front of you belong? Then you shall say, these belong to your servant Jacob. It is a present sent to my lord Esau. And behold, he is also behind us. Then he commanded also the second and the third, and all those who followed the drove, saying, after this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him. You shall say, behold, your servant Jacob also is behind us. For he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me. Then afterward I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept. So, what's going to happen here is he's going to take the 200 goats, and the 200 female goats, the 20 male goats, and he puts them in one group. And they go. And then he waits a little while, and he gathers another group. And they go. And he waits a little while, and he gathers another group, and they go. So there's going to be space between the droves. So Esau is going to come along the road, and you come along 220 animals that are being shepherded along the road. And what's this? Where are you going? What is this? Well, these are a present to you from your servant Jacob. Well, it's like anything else. If somebody gave you a house, you'd go look at it. You're going to stop and check out the sheep. This is the goats. This is neat. I guess I get 220 goats. Let's take a look and see what they have. Well, that worked. And then you get back on your horses and you head on down the road with your 400 men. And not long later, you come across another large flock. And you say, where are you going? Who are you? And they say to Esau, these are a gift from your servant Jacob. So now you look at the sheep. I wonder if most of them were spotted and speckled in the street. Esau's going, this is great, but why are they all spotted? So you see what's happening. First of all, it's going to break up the time. Jacob is buying time. Second of all, it appeases anger because over time, the anger starts to dilute. The anger starts to diffuse. And it's a wise course of action, all things considered. The other thing that's interesting here is Jacob is putting himself entirely at the mercy of Esau. He's not assembling a defensive position. He's choosing a humble position. He's totally at the mercy of Esau. So, we continue on. Verse 21, so the present, that is the gift that was for Esau, passed on before him, and he himself spent that night in the camp. So what I believe happened is it took all day to assemble these flocks and to send them down the road. And then as evening comes, as the last of these flocks go down the road, and so begins another night. And this is the second night. Now he arose that same night, and I believe this is early evening, perhaps just after nightfall. And he takes his two wives and his two maids and his 11 children, and he crossed the ford at Jabbok. He's already crossed the Jordan, and then there's a tributary of the Jordan called the Jabbok, and now he's going to cross the Jabbok. He took them and he sent them across the stream, and he sent across whatever he had. So he's taken everything else and he sent it across this little stream, the ford of Jabbok. And Jacob, verse 24, says Jacob was left alone. That is, Jacob went back across the Jabbok. So Jacob is between the two rivers, between the Jordan and the Jabbok. And Jacob was left alone. At the end of all things, that's where you are. At the end of yourself, it's just you. And Jacob has sent everything on ahead, and now he's alone with himself. And then you have this line, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. All the commentaries indicate everybody pretty much is in agreement that the man is at least the angel of God. Most likely it was Jesus in his pre-form. And there's a number of times throughout the Old Testament where a character will appear, the angel of God or God, and by all reading, it appears that it's Jesus. And that makes sense for what's happening here. And so we have this exchange of when this man wrestled with Jacob until daybreak. We're going to read through this, just the next six verses or so. There's a bunch of pronouns in here, he. You see a bunch of he's, and it can get confusing. So I'm going to insert who's who as we read through it. The version that I read from is NASB, if that's helpful. Verse 25, when he, that is the man, saw that he, the man, had not prevailed against him, Jacob. He, the man, touched the socket of Jacob's thigh, so the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. Then he, the man, said, let me go, for the dawn is breaking. But he, Jacob, said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. So the man said to him, Jacob, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. The man said, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. Jacob asked the man, please tell me your name. But he said, why is it that you ask my name? And he, the man, blessed him there. So Jacob named the place Peniel, for he said, I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved. Now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Peniel, and he was limping on his thigh. So we have this very unique passage in the Bible. Nowhere else in the Bible do you see somebody wrestling with God, face to face, hand to hand, grappling with God. We're not told how Jacob comes to wrestle with the angel. There's no preamble, no introduction, no context, really, other than the context of Jacob. But there was no introduction. There's no, then a man came across the river. Or in a flash of light, a man appeared. There's nothing. It's a man wrestled with him until daybreak. The absence of a beginning, the absence of a preamble, points to this idea that Jacob has always been wrestling. It's not anything unusual. It's just, oh yeah, and a man was wrestling with him. Because the truth of the matter is, Jacob's been wrestling his whole life. Jacob has been striving against man and against God his whole life. And so it's just, yeah, of course there's a man wrestling with him. Why is this anything different? This has been a feature of Jacob's life. He contended with everyone and with God. In verse 26, we see the angel saying, let me go, for the dawn is breaking. And what the angel is saying, they've wrestled over the night, and the dawn is coming. And the angel saying, let me go, the dawn is breaking. What he's saying is, it's enough. You've wrestled enough. It's time for a new day. It's time for a change. Here comes the new day. Here comes the sun. This is the day you're going to see Esau. Let's move beyond. Let's cross the river and leave everything else behind. Let me go. Stop wrestling. Jacob responds with, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Which, okay, that makes sense, but think about this. Jacob is actually quite prosperous. Jacob received first, although it under circumstances, but still, he has the blessing of his father. He has the blessing of Isaac. That is something a man carries until his death. He has his father's blessing. He has the blessing of the prosperity that he earned under Laban. He has the blessing of, his wives and his children. He is technically a blessed man. So what blessing is it that he's asking for? Does he want more blessing? Or is it rather, Jacob wants a different blessing? Jacob wants the blessing that God would give. Realize that you've spent your entire life striving, creating your own identity, establishing your own purposes, becoming all that you can be. You realize that it's all just chasing after the wind. Remember all the creative breeding that Jacob did? Remember the blessing? All the flocks and the stuff that he blessed that God gave to him? Well, a big portion of that just went to Esau. It might buy him mercy from Esau, but it comes in and it goes out. This is the message that Solomon wrote about in Ecclesiastes. It's all just striving after the wind. Remember, Jacob said, by day the heat consumed me, and the frost by night, and sleep fled from my eyes. After all that effort, after all that energy, in the end it was really all just disposable anyway. Enough of my blessings. Enough of this. I will not let you go until you bless me. I've got you face to face. I've got you in my grasp. I'm not letting go. You bless me with what you have. Remember, everything else is on the other side of the river. Jacob has discarded everything. I mean, granted, he still has it, but he's put everything over there. And now I'm face to face with the angel. Now you bless me. Now God, you bless me. I'm not letting go because I don't want that. Whatever I've done there is that. I want this. I want this. So the man says to Jacob, what is your name? Who are you? The man is asking. The man is saying, well, who are you? He's forcing Jacob to confront himself. What is Jacob's response? My name is Jacob. Usurper, thief, conniver. This is how I am known. This is my name. My identity, my reputation, my curse, if it proves to be. This is how I am known. Who are you? The man asks Jacob. Because we're forced to confront ourselves. And we're forced to realize that we have established this identity. We've established this thing of us. This is the me. Remember I read Tennyson. There's a line in that poem earlier where he says, I am become a name. It's an old-fashioned kind of phrase. I am become a name. It means I have become a name. I am a name. I have become something. I am my name. The essence, the extent of identity, self-established. This is who I am. The man makes a prophecy to Jacob. You shall no longer be known as Jacob. Your name will be changed to Israel. For you have striven with both God and men and have overcome. So, you have this moment where God is saying to Jacob, you've striven with both God and men and have overcome. Now he's still in the grasp. He's still wrestling, still grappling. He hasn't let go. This is in that moment. What did he overcome? You're not going to overcome God. That doesn't work. That just doesn't make any sense. What is it that he's overcome? He's overcome himself. He's overcome his own sense of agenda, of purpose, of drive. But it's not final, is it? The night's not over. The next day's going to come. He has to walk it out. So this is where he's at. He's been given a prophecy. In God's perspective, he has overcome because he is overcoming because he will overcome. That's how God sees it. Then Jacob asks him this most audacious of requests. Please tell me your name. The man said, why do you ask my name? If you look around this building and most evangelical churches, you don't see images. You don't see icons. You don't see figurines. You don't see images of God. We've inherited from the Jewish Old Testament. Thou shalt not engrave an image of God. We have no images of God. If you think about it and close your eyes and think, okay, who is God? What is God look like? If you were to do that, we might have a caricature. We might have a silly representation of maybe an old man looking person, robes, beard. But we kind of know that's not it. What do we have? What is it that we hold on to? It's his name. That's what we hold in our minds is evidence of God. That's our God is his name. Why did you ask my name? The angel says. Remember what Jacob was calling God. First God, the God of Abraham, the fear of Isaac. Later it was the God of my father Abraham, the God of my father Isaac. Now that he's face to face wrestling with God, Jacob asks for a name. What is the name that I will hold on to from this day forward? Why did the man say, why did you ask my name? Because the significance of that question is the important thing. Jacob needed to know that he needed to know God's name. See, Jacob has had God at arm's length all this time. It's the Heisman, right? Keeping him at arm's length. Jacob needed to hold God's name in his head, in his heart. This needed to be my God. Jesus asked a question of his disciples in Matthew 16. We have this little passage. Verse 13, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he was asking his disciples, who do people say the Son of Man is? And they said, some say John the Baptist, others Elijah, still others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. He said to them, who do you say that I am? Simon Peter answered him, you are the Christ, the Son of God, the Son of the living God. Jesus said to him, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, Flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. We need to know his name. In chapter 33, the next chapter, we read in verses 17, Jacob journeyed on to Sukkot. Later, verse 19, he traveled on to Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, finally entering the promised land. In verse 20, he erected an altar and he called it El Elohe Israel. Remember, his name has been changed to Israel. El Elohe Israel. El for God. Elohe, the God of Israel. God, the God of Israel. El Elohe is loosely translated as God, you are my God. Or God, you are the God of. El Elohim and El Elohe. So he's called this altar El Elohe Israel. So finally, God has become his God. Back to chapter 32, Jacob named the place Peniel, where he said, I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved. Now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Peniel. He was limping on his thigh. This version uses life. My life has been preserved. Other translations use soul. I think this is an important distinction. When you are standing face to face with God, what stands? What remains? What falls away? The only thing that stands of me is my soul, my agenda, my purpose, my identity, everything, my humanity, everything that I have defined. All that falls away when I stand in the true presence of God. So Jacob crossed the river again, another turning point, never to go back, and Jacob limped along his way. So we conclude our brief survey of Genesis 32. I want to look at this wrestling, this striving, a little closer. I want to look at it from the perspective of prayer. First, we have this encounter with Jacob where he is fleeing the wrath of his brother. He comes to Bethel, lays his head down on a rock, and has a vision. The vision is of this ladder stretching to heaven. God is over the ladder with the angels going up and down the ladder. Angels are described throughout the Bible as messengers. But what this isn't a picture to me, this is a picture to me of prayer and my wife and I talked about this last night, and we called it balloon prayers. And they are the prayers that you take and you tie to a balloon and you send it out. And it's kind of a pretty picture. But it's not face to face. It's not grappling. It's not wrestling. Contrast this with the type of prayer that you could see in the story of Jacob wrestling, contending, grappling, agonizing. In wrestling with God, Jacob had confronted God's sovereignty. And isn't this what we do when we pray? We confront God's sovereignty. We run up against God's sovereignty. And we have to interact with Him in His sovereignty. God, you are God. You are this. But I need to come to you. My wife is sick. My child is sick. I need to come to you. My brother needs to know you. My sister needs to be saved. You're sovereign, you're in charge of this, but I have to interact with you. I have to come face to face. Come, let's grapple with this. You can still be God, but I have to wrestle with you on this. We are often affected in areas of our health, or in those of the health that we love. These are examples of times when we pray, interacting in the realm of His sovereignty. We travail. We weep, we give God no rest with our pleas. We plead for healing, for rescue, for salvation. We grapple with God in prayer. In the process, we are the ones transformed. We are the ones changed. I'll tell you a personal story. A little bit about me. Some time ago, I had a particular issue that I wanted to resolve. This is an issue that was a struggle in my life for a long time. And it reached the point where I was no longer content with this. This situation had become untenable. And I was no longer resolved to patiently wait for God to resolve this situation, but I wanted it resolved now. And I felt that it was untenable for me and for my family. And so I shared this with a friend, and this particular friend suggested that I could wrestle with God in prayer over this issue. same way Jacob wrestled in prayer. And I thought, well, that's a pretty good idea. Maybe I'll try that. And so, one thing about me, I tend to, when I do something, I tend to do it somewhat wholeheartedly when I get around to it. But what I resolved to do is I would pray. And I distilled this prayer, this issue, down to one or two sentences, three or four sentences. And this is my prayer. And then I began to pray this prayer over and over and over and over again. I gave God truly no rest, 2, 3, 4 hours a day. I gave God no rest. And I prayed the same prayer over and over again. I would pace in my yard in the back of our house, and I wore a groove in the grass as I paced and I prayed. I fell asleep praying, and I woke up praying. This is not because I am a particular pious or spiritual person. Rather, I think it's more because I'm a belligerent person that I would get in God's face like this. I would truly give Him no rest, and I would pray this one prayer. So this lasted for 3, 4, 5 weeks, and I began to see that I began to suffer, and I began to get ill. I lost a lot of weight. My doctor said, you weigh less than 120 pounds. What's wrong with you? We need to run some tests. And I declined the tests. I said, I'm fine. But I was praying. I explained it to my friends that it was as if I had approached the Rock of Gibraltar, and I'd set my feet in the sand, put my shoulder to the stone, my cheek to the rock, and I pushed. I was wrestling with God, and I gave Him truly no rest. So I kept up this regimen of prayer as the weeks went by, and it began to take its toll. And I came to the place where I was no longer grappling, I was no longer wrestling, but I wasn't letting go. My prayer had become a mumble. And I was exhausted, but I would not let go. And after about 6 weeks or so, I discovered something. God showed me a little deeper truth. You see, I'd grappled and I'd striven with God, but He would not be moved. It's the irresistible force and the immovable object, except for I was not irresistible. Something had to give. And that something was me. When you confront God and His sovereignty, we are the ones who are changed. We are the ones who are transformed. We are the ones who are broken. I realized that my only hope was surrender. See, I'm not unlike Jacob or Ulysses. I am also that force which moves earth and heaven. I am the unyielding one, even in the presence of God. Submission, surrender, these are similar words. I prefer surrender in this case because it speaks to the conflict, to the battle, to the contention. According to Merriam-Webster, surrender means to agree to stop fighting, hiding, resisting, etc. because you know that you will not win or succeed. So I realized that my prayer had become obsolete. I needed a new prayer. This is what's broken. You come to God in His sovereignty, and you realize that it's about your surrender, that you submit yourself to His sovereignty. It changes you. It breaks you. But being broken is not bad. Jacob walked the rest of his life with a limp. If we are weak in God, that's a good thing. So, this is where I came to. My prayer had become obsolete. I needed a new prayer. And I wrote a crafted prayer for this. And I'm just going to read through this. It was on a note card, and I carried it in my pocket for weeks. And I would say it multiple times a day. Jesus, please make my words true. Please make my surrender complete. I address this to Jesus deliberately because He's the King of the universe, and I wanted my surrender, my submission to be Him, to Him as King. All authority under heaven and earth has been given to Jesus, and so I wanted to surrender to Him. I wanted that submission to be to Him specifically. I surrender the entirety of my life, the whole of me, the all of me. I confess this to You, that I've tried to hold my life in my own hands, to define my own self. I confess that I have held my dreams, the definition of myself, the essence of my life, in my own tiny cupped hands, that I have breathed on it, that I have brooded over it, that I have sought to bring to life that which I wanted for myself. What it is we tend to have like an ember in our hands of our life. This is me. This is my identity. This is who I am. This is who I want to be. And we sit there and we brood over it. And we breathe on it. We try to bring it to life. It's the same image as the Holy Spirit brooding over the surface of chaos, over the surface of the waters, to bring forth life. We look down into this. This is my life. And we brood over it. This is me. I want to bring this to life. I give this back, I wrote. My life, I return this to you. For all things come from God and all things return to God. I relinquish any hold, any tie, any reservation to this life. I release all promises, all assurances, except one, the assurance of surrender. For you are God, and I surrender to you. I resolve not to take up my life again, to not take it up again as if it were my own. Rather, I have been purchased, redeemed by the one who holds and has always held ownership to my life. If I do take up my life again, as if it is mine, then I resolve to surrender it again, and again if necessary, till my surrender is complete. You see, it's this discipline. It's something that we have to do again and again. You have to do it again. We take it up again. We take up our life. So you surrender it again. And it's okay. And we all do it. Sometimes we get into a place where it's like, oh, I took my life up again. I give up. No, just surrender it again. It's okay. I think he understands. Only in your perfect time and in your perfect will I receive the life you have for me. In the meantime, I surrender all this to you. I kneel down and I place this tattered bundle of cloths, these shards of broken dreams at your feet. I open my hands, I let go, I stand up, and I step back. Jesus, please make my words true. Please make my surrender complete. So, this is where I ended up in my wrestling with God. This is one of the reasons why this story resonates with me so much. We have this idea, and I talked earlier about the promises of God as a crowbar. That we leverage our way into the blessings of God. When you surrender, when you give your life to God, He holds the promises. You see that? He gives us the promises. He promises us all the promises that He gives us, blessings, health, right, and care. And we have a tendency to say, you promised me this, take care of me, take care of this. You promised to take care of these things. But when you surrender your life, when you give your life back to Him, not only did He author the promises, but now He's responsible for collecting on the promise. He collects from himself, because now the promise is made to him. I don't have to say, what about this promise over here? Because he owns me. Collect your own promise in your own time. And I give it to you. So Jacob had wrestled with God. He had striven his whole life with men. Now he had the chance face to face with God. But rather than overcome God, Jacob was overcome. Injured, but he would not let go. God blessed him and transformed him and changed him. And isn't that just our prayer? I have copies of this prayer. You might find it helpful. It doesn't have my name on it. It's not about promoting me. But I'll leave copies up here, and you're welcome to come and take one if you like.